You know, many people move through life with invisible conditions that greatly affect their day-to-day functions. And today we're going to be talking about one you may or may not have heard of. It's called Sjogren's disease, and it's kind of a weird spelling. It's probably a Dr. Sjogren that found it. It's S-J-O-G-R-E-N-S. Apostrophe S. Sjogren's disease, one of the hidden disorders affecting a person's immune system. And our guest today, Dr. Sarah McCoy, will be answering questions from you about Sjogren's disease. She's a clinical rheumatologist at UW Health, and she directs the Sjogren's Syndrome Clinic. And Dr. McCoy is also an associate professor in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and the Division of Rheumatology. So maybe you have Sjogren's. What do you want other people to know about your condition? Wondering how you can help maybe a family member who's just been diagnosed. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Sarah McCoy, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
I'm really great to be talking about this, about Sjogren's syndrome. Just maybe to start, and we did touch on this a bit with our previous guest, Dr. Abidat, but autoimmune diseases. I have a relative who has an autoimmune disease, and one of the questions I've often got is, well, what the heck is an autoimmune disease just in to begin with? So in general, what happens?
Yeah, and we get that question a lot. Why do some people get autoimmunity? What is autoimmunity? Autoimmunity is when your immune system, which should be fighting off bacteria and viruses, start to recognize yourself as foreign, and it attacks self. And there are lots of different examples of autoimmune disease, right? So some you may have heard of are lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and it can be systemic, meaning every organ in your body or can affect any, or it can be local. One example would be things like MS that tend to focus on one part of your body.
Yeah. And Sjogren's, what's happening to your body with Sjogren's?
So we call this a systemic autoimmune disease, meaning it can go many places. And we also call it an exocrinopathy.
Boo.
Oh, I know. So those are glands that make things. And in the case of Sjogren's, what's happening is the exocrine glands specifically that make tears and saliva are attacked by your immune system. And so as a result, you get dry. And the phenotypic, or what the characteristic features are that we see, are severe dry eye and dry mouth. Not pleasant. And, you know, in addition to that severe dryness, a lot of our patients experience extreme fatigue and pain. And those three symptoms together are sort of our cardinal symptom trifecta that we see in Sjogren's: dryness and pain and fatigue.
Well, that's got to have a huge impact on the quality of your life.
It has a marked impact on our patient quality of life. And you really can get into the nitty-gritty of it when they have systemic disease that affects them differently than when they have disease that largely affects the saliva and tear production. But even then, sometimes it's hard to imagine an absence of something.
Yeah.
But if you can imagine not being able to eat food or talk or not be able to see the computer screen, those factors really affect our patient's quality of life.
Yeah, I would think so. Chris in Wausau has wants to share something about her experience. Chris, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I've had Sjogren's for probably 20 years, and it's just so unusual. No one ever knows what it is. So when you had your program, I had a call. And Larry, you always have great shows. But I've found great relief with using Retain. It's an eye drop. I have to put them in first before I even get out of bed in the morning, because otherwise I can't see. I mean, that's one thing I do. The other thing, being gluten-free seems to help some.
Hmm.
But it, But in the winter, I get so bad, my lips just almost peel off. And my mouth gets so dry. I don't know if there's anything. I mean, it gets really bad.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine, you know, my mouth gets a little dry in the winter and my nose gets a little dry in the winter, and I'll even have an occasional nosebleed if I blow my nose too hard. So, but somebody like Chris, with Sjogren's, is probably magnified quite a bit.
It is. It's quite severe. And what she mentions is commonly some of the strategies we see people adopt. So, for example, with a severe dry eye, we recommend preservative-free eye drops. And then some people, even before they go to bed at night, we have them put in a thick oil or thicker lubricant to try to protect the eyes overnight. We conceal the eyes, and then especially in Wisconsin, the humidity is low. And so we recommend maintaining higher humidity in the household and even right by the bedside.
Yeah, that makes... What about gluten-free?
So that was an interesting observation. In general, our autoimmune diseases like Sjogren's can be associated with intolerances more. But it's important to differentiate gluten intolerance versus the actual phenomenon celiac disease. And we do appreciate that in our Sjogren's patients.
Chris, I'm sorry you have Sjogren's, but you seem to be doing about as well as... She's got a good attitude, hasn't she?
Absolutely.
I like your attitude, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very, very much. How common is Sjogren's?
Ooh. So I would like to say that we move science forward, but we don't have a great idea about how common it is. And I'll paint the landscape as to why we don't. So... We know that around a third of individuals will have dryness at some point, right? Like you said, in the winter, I get some dry mouth. And we know that a fair amount of patients go to their eye doctor with dry mouth symptoms or their dentist with dry mouth symptoms. Yeah. But only a few of the patients who are really dry trickle into something called rheumatology, right? Which is where I reside.
Not the first thing that comes to mind, I guess.
Right. And so... Actually, the numbers when we do studies are very, very low here in the U.S. and in this region of the Midwest. But most rheumatologists think it's an underestimate because people aren't sent to rheumatology. They go to their doctor and their dentist, their eye doctor and their dentist. And for that reason, we think it's more common. We think it's probably around 1% of the population, probably second most compared to rheumatoid arthritis in terms of the rheumatologic diseases.
But that's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people.
Sounds small, 1%, but that's all. It turns into a lot of people.
It sure is. It is a lot of people, and especially as we raise awareness, I would suspect that prevalence will increase.
Samantha and Ettrick has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. God bless you both. Anyway, I was just wondering. The movie that I've seen or, you know, things I've heard of like The Boy in the Bubble, is that something that actually, you know, like somebody can happen to someone where they have low immune system or none and they have to be in their house or something in a sterile environment 24/7? And what's that like? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. A little off, but not so bad.
Yeah, so an immune deficiency certainly can happen, and there are variations to that. And actually, some kinds of immune deficiencies can be associated with autoimmunity, but it's actually sort of a totally separate thing, and they're treated differently. So rheumatologists typically don't see those folks as often as immunologists or allergists might.
But there are people like that boy in the bubble movie.
With severe immunodeficiency, and they are prone to infections, and so they have to take certain precautions that we might not think of.
Wow. I'm wondering about men versus women on this. Women are more likely, I guess, to have MS than men. What about when it comes to Sjogren?
So we like to think that our disease is one of the most female predominant autoimmune diseases. So the ratio is as high as 20 to 1 female to male. the lower, more conservative estimate would be 14 to 16 to 1 female to male. So it is one of the most female predominant systemic autoimmune diseases.
And causes?
As to why it's female predominant? Well, we have a lot of guesses. We don't 100% know, but recently some X-linked gene traits were discovered. And actually, out of OMRF, there have been really great studies looking at people who have an extra X chromosome. And it's not that common that this happens, but in those individuals, they have a higher risk of Sjogren's. So we think there's something with the X chromosome. And then you can also think about hormones. So Sjogren's tends to have an onset around perimenopause. Mm. And so there's also a little bit of research supporting maybe it's estrogen or the estrogen-androgen ratio and the change around menopause that may allow the disease to show itself.
We will get more into detail on that part of our conversation and a whole lot more with our guest today, Dr. Sarah McCoy, clinical rheumatologist at UW Health and the director of the Sjogren's Syndrome Clinic on campus. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. We'll be back. She'll be with us right up till 12:30, and we'll be back right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about Sjogren's syndrome. It's a disorder in the immune system. And our guest can answer all your questions. Dr. Sarah McCoy is a clinical rheumatologist at UW Health, director of the Sjogren's Syndrome Clinic. And Dr. McCoy, also an associate professor in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health in the Division of Rheumatology. So, curious? Have some questions about Sjogren's? Maybe you want to know how you can spread awareness. We certainly, I'm sure Dr. McCoy would welcome any comments that you might have in that area, too. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to ideas at WPR.org. Emily in Dubuque, Iowa has a question for you, Dr. McCoy. Let's go there. Hi, Emily. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Good to talk to you today. I have questions about the symptoms, again, of Sjogren's. I'm sorry I didn't tune in sooner in the show. If you've already covered this, I'll just go back and re-listen later. I was wondering about presentation of symptoms, exterior lips. So I know it's mouth and salivary glands. Is there ever presentation early on, prodromal perhaps, in the exterior surface of the lips? Or nostrils, or perhaps presenting with excess salt secreted overnight from your tear ducts due to damage there. I will take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling, Emily.
So I think a good place to start are what are symptoms of dryness that may indicate you have Sjogren's disease? And then I can end up with sort of what the lips, how the lips can be involved, because we also had another caller who mentioned that problem as well. So dryness, as we talked about, is pretty common. So how can you tell if your symptoms are severe enough to be concerned about Sjogren's disease? And one is chronicity. So you should have daily persistent severe dry eye for at least 3 months.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And then a daily feeling of sand or gravel in the eye.
Ooh.
Yeah. And then having to use tear replacements more than 3 times a day might indicate also that you're dry. From the mouth perspective, sort of similar. So a daily persistent dry mouth for more than 3 months. In this situation, you might ask yourself, well, do I have to take a sip of liquid to swallow dry foods? And then the thing that's most specific for Sjogren's is if you've ever had swelling, persistent or recurrent swelling of your salivary glands, which live kind of by your ears and under your jaw. Now, In regards to the lip dryness, so we do see lip dryness in Sjogren's disease, and typically it's just that cracking, dryness, chapped lips. And in that situation, we do recommend, again, humidification and then a lot of topical protection we try to use to address those symptoms as well.
So is that the first symptom, or is that a later symptom typically? So maybe it's not Sjogren's?
So usually in my patients, we don't have data on lip dryness coming first. I usually don't see it as the first manifestation of my patients. A lot of times what I'll see is actually things like, oh yeah, I did have cavities all through this period of my life despite brushing all the time. Or, you know, oh yeah, my ophthalmologist, my eye doctor did tell me I had dry eye, but I thought it was normal. Usually those are the features, the oral or the ocular features, the eye or the mouth that we pick up earlier before diagnosis.
Let's take a call from Carol in Madison. Hi, Carol. Thank you for calling.
Oh, okay. Well, I have actually three related questions. They're pretty specific.
Okay.
So I'll just say them in a row. I think they all make sense. So what treatments are available once Sjogren's is diagnosed? Okay. Where is research going on now? I mean, what kinds of things are happening in research and where? And then, is Scandinavian heritage a factor in this, or just family DNA or genes?
All right. All right.
All right.
You took some of those questions right out of my mouth, Carol. Thanks for calling.
So that, I think, is a great question. So first off, what can we do about it, right? Well, we'll lead off with a little bit of bad news in that we have no FDA-approved disease-modifying therapies, therapies that can treat the underlying disease. But we do have approaches to treat the sequela, whether it's dryness or other organ involvement that can happen with Sjogren's disease. And for the dryness, it's pretty algorithmic. So we recommend for the mouth and the eye wetting agents, for the mouth chewing things to help produce or stimulate saliva. And then also we can give agents that help make saliva, and those are called sialagogues. And to be a little more depressing, actually, some of the first patients described to have Sjogren's in the 1800s were treated with the same drug, which is pilocarpine, or a relation to it that we do today. So I tell my patients it's very safe. We've had it for hundreds of years, but we haven't evolved very far beyond it. Now, when you have organs involved, like joints or lungs involved, we do have other drugs we can use that are stronger, but they don't treat the whole process.
Okay.
So question two, if I heard right, was where are we going?
Yeah, and where's the research?
This is the sun rising in the horizon. This is where we're moving now. So the past few decades, we have had no positive trials. But in the past 5 to 10 years, for the first time, we've started to see positive results in clinical trials. And this has really been accelerating over the last few years. And so now we have multiple drugs that met their phase 2 primary endpoints for the first time. And they're just moving to phase 3 trials. So I tell all my patients, hang on, we have a lot of drug trials coming out in the near future, and they should result in a disease-modifying drug. And I'll put in one plug. We host at UW clinical trials as part of a way to help our patients.
Sure.
And one of the fun ones will be starting in the near future is a stem cell trial, where we're going to be taking our patient's own stem cells, harvesting them, and then we optimize them in a little incubator, and then we'll give them right back to you, but in your glands that help you make saliva. So that's a really fun study that we have. Really, I think we should initiate in the next few weeks here.
So can somebody sign up for it?
They sure can. So right now, they can contact the UW, or they can come through my clinic. This is a phase 1. We're just doing a test. But hopefully, if things go well, we'll expand. And then especially at that point, we'll be looking for willing participants.
Very, very good. And Carol, let's see. We also have Scandinavian.
So the third part of that was Scandinavian heritage and genetics. So you were right. Henrik Sjogren and his wife, Maria, were ophthalmologists. And out of Sweden. And so they are, it tends to be more common regionally of people who are of Scandinavian descent. It also can be common in certain areas of Asia. But again, because those prevalence studies, country to country and region to region, are so variable, we have a little bit of trouble with that. We do think there's some genetic association, and we have really big studies that are helping us understand that, but it's not all genetics. There are other factors that drive disease onset aside from just your genes.
Carol, thank you again. Those were all great questions. Let's go to Nancy in Greene County next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'd like to know how Sjogren's affects or can affect the central nervous system. And since you mentioned it before, lungs as well. And why does that happen? Since I don't think those are part of the exocrine system.
Okay. Another interesting pair of questions.
Yeah. So actually, this is pretty salient because Sjogren's, when it affects the central nervous system, can actually present like an MS-like disease. So I work very closely with our multiple sclerosis doctors when we have someone who has Sjogren's and abnormalities in their MRI or in the fluid around their spine, because it can be very difficult to sort out Sjogren's that looks like MS or MS. And usually I rely heavily on my neurology friends. Rarely it can affect the blood vessels in the brain. And those are some of the more severe manifestations of our Sjogren's, as inflammation of the spinal fluid or the blood vessels, or again, this MS-like disease. It also, and that, like I said, is pretty uncommon. A little more common is lungs being involved, and it can do a host of things in the lungs. So the trachea can get very dry. That's called xerotrachea with an X, and that can be uncomfortable and lead to a chronic cough. It can cause almost an obstructive lung disease, like you might see with smoking, involving the smaller airways. And then lastly, it can cause something called interstitial lung disease, where the tiny bubbles at the end of the airway, the alveoli, get inflamed and thickened, and it can make breathing difficult.
Wow. that's a Nancy, thank you so much. By the way, you could join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Taking a look at an email from Jerry now. They have Raynaud's syndrome and cervical dystonia. As part of these, they also have some thoracic outlet syndrome symptoms. Can any of these be manifestations of MS or Sjogren's? Brain MRI show no lesions, but they did not have an IV during the MRI. Not sure if that was with or without contrast.
So the cervical dystonia and the thoracic outlet syndrome are not going to be related to Sjogren's. The Raynaud's is common in Sjogren's disease and in many of our autoimmune diseases. And so when we go through our big questionnaire when people first come in, we talk about folks' Raynaud's. And to talk about what Raynaud's is, if your viewers don't know, is it's when you get fingers that change color in the cold. And it's normal. If you and I are shoveling and it's negative 15 degrees, our fingers are going to turn white. But very specifically, they turn at least two colors and sometimes three when exposed to very mild coldness, like you're in the freezer aisle at the grocery store. They'll turn white and then blue, or white, blue, and then red. So that's what Raynaud's is. And we do see it in Sjogren's along with other autoimmune diseases.
Seems like, well, I just happen to know. Maybe it's just me, but I happen to know three or four people at least with that issue.
It's pretty common.
Yeah, it's dealt with. They deal with it. There are some medications that you can deal with it.
Yeah, we usually, with most things, we start off more conservatively, where we recommend, you know, maintaining central warmth, wearing hats, multiple layers, making sure the hands and the feet have appropriate gloves. And then after we go beyond warming, you're right, we can use drugs that dilate blood vessels, because what we think is that the blood vessels are spasming, and so you aren't getting blood flow to the tip of your fingers. And by giving a drug that dilates the blood vessel, we can help get the blood where it needs to go.
How did you get interested, Dr. McCoy, in Sjogren's? Obviously, you know, you're director of the Sjogren's Syndrome Clinic, which you may have founded or at least had some big impact on.
Yeah, so for me, it really was a patient population that I think had the least advocacy at the time when I was going through training, and there was the most need. So with my skill set, which is limited as it is, I do research, I do clinical trials, I thought that I could maybe help the most in that scenario. These patients really have a marked symptom burden and a burden on their lives, but there really, as we talked about, isn't much available to treat them. And so I was hoping that maybe with some of my research background, we could work to develop new therapies or with a clinical expertise to host clinical trials and try to develop these treatments that will finally address the patient's needs.
And you've been honored for your advocacy work.
I just this weekend, actually, I got a Sjogren's Foundation Award. Yeah.
Good for you, and I know it's well-deserved. Oh, man. Donna in Middleton has a question for you, so let's go there. Hey, Donna.
Hi. I have a burning mouth syndrome, and I'm wondering if that has anything to do with Sjogren's.
Does that appear in people with Sjogren's?
It sure can. So several things can cause burning mouth, but one of the causes is dryness. And a lot of my patients will come to clinic with burning mouth. And the first thing we do is an examination. Sometimes there's some thrush present, actually. And in patients who have very dry mouth, they may not present with classic thrush that most primary care doctors will see, which is like a big plaque, white plaques on in the mouth. Instead, if you already have a very dry mouth, you just may get a bright red tongue where the papilla sort of looks flat on the tongue instead of with the little bumps that you typically see. And you might just have a lot more sensitivity to spicy foods and other foods. Or you just might have cracking and sort of changes at the corner of your mouth. And if that's the case, then treating the thrush can actually make the burning mouth better. If that doesn't work and you still have a very dry mouth on examination, which we can sort out in the clinic pretty easily, then we do try to treat the dry mouth to see if that will help the burning tongue. If that doesn't work, then we'll try to go to medicines to try to mitigate the burning sensation itself. And we'll make sure certainly that it's not another cause other than Sjogren's disease.
Your research, one of your projects involved working on the, mesenchymal stoma cells? Did I get that right?
You are so close.
Story of my life.
Well, you know, it's funny because I did research when I was in training and then I came to Wisconsin and I didn't really know where to go. And one of my current mentors walked by my office and I said, hey, you know, I'm really interested in this thing called Sjogren's and helping these people. And he said, you know, I study a cell called mesenchymal stromal cells, or MSCs for short. And he said, you can just come to my lab and do your research there. And that's actually how it all started. And I went right back to the wet bench. And that is what I study, are these MSCs from different sources. Like bone marrow is one common source. When you hear these stem cell trials, they're getting stem cells from bone marrow. Another more recent source has been adipose, so like fat cells they have been getting stem cells from and treating dryness from radiation. And then what I'm interested in is looking at the stem cells actually from your salivary gland and how they may differ or be similar and from different sources, so salivary gland versus bone marrow, but also different in Sjogren's disease or other dryness diseases compared to people who aren't dry.
Well, it's a pretty cool sounding research, and that's ongoing. So, results of that are yet to be made. Somebody else wondered about tear duct surgery is what I wanted to say. And when is that useful for people, and when is it done?
Yeah, I like to think of the eye in a very simplistic way. I'm sorry, ophthalmologists who may be listening, is sort of a bathtub. And how can you keep that tub full of water? And there are three really simplistic ways of doing that. So one is to keep putting water into the bathtub that's trying to drain. Two is to put a cover over it so it doesn't evaporate. And three is to plug the drain, right? And so we do a lot of this already. So we fill the eyes with our preservative-free tears and ointments, and we cover it with what I had mentioned earlier, these moisture chamber goggles. But we also can plug the draining ducts, and you have four of them, two in each eye, and they're actually in the inner corner of the eye, and you can see them if you look in the mirror. And your ophthalmologist can put in a silicone or other kind collagen plug, whichever kind, into all four of them, and that'll prevent the tears from draining. Now, sometimes the plugs fall out or they dissolve frequently, and it can be a hassle. And if the symptoms are really improved by plugging those ducts, your ophthalmologist can sometimes sort of ablate the duct, get rid of it in its entirety.
And you're not going to, once you have this, it's not going to go away ever. I was thinking, well, if you plug them up and then suddenly the disease goes away, then you're crying all the time.
Yeah, the dryness tends to be chronic. And so usually by the time we get to that point, we're not talking about symptoms for 3 or 6 months. Usually it's been years of symptoms. And most commonly the trajectory is once people are dry, the dryness is progressive. Some folks go into remission, but I'd have to say that in terms of the dryness symptoms, that would be the exception, not the rule.
Yeah. So here we are coming down to the last couple of minutes. What do you hope, ultimately, what do you hope to learn about Sjogren's through these various research projects? And what are your goals, I guess, for helping people with Sjogren's?
You know, anything. So really, to be more specific, if we had a drug that I could tell patients, this really will help your underlying disease, I think that would be really gratifying for my patients and also for physicians, because it can always be tricky seeing patients when there isn't a quick fix. And, you know, your callers, as they said, they're figuring out themselves how to treat these symptoms. But I would love to be able to have developed a targeted therapy with not a lot of side effects that would help our patients' symptoms and actually modify the underlying disease. One of your callers mentioned, you know, what about the brain involvement? What about the lung involvement? Well, there are other organs that can be involved, and that can be pretty scary for a lot of our patients. And in those scenarios, having a drug that might modify the disease and how it acts badly would be really reassuring.
Yeah, it's great to know, and we were just learning earlier about MS. There are so many pills and other things that we can take to modify, but we haven't gotten quite that far yet with Sjogren's.
Exactly. And so one of the first steps, and it seems slow, we have drugs in development that look promising, but I think we really have moved forward with our understanding of the disease. But I think really digging in and understanding all of the pathogenic pathways, and two, every person is so different, right? There's not one gene that we've found. There's not one inciting factor. So really, what's driving this and how does that differ from person to person? And I think that's really what our advanced technology is letting us do, is not only say overall what's happening, but actually substratify patients to try to understand how this disease acts differently in different people.
And I bet it's sort of like MS, again, thinking back to that since it is individual, you really need, if you sit down with somebody, you really need to get a good idea of their history and what they do and so forth.
That's exactly it. And this is another paper we published, and since then it's gone on to evolve and how we can best stratify patients so that, one, we can maybe, if we group people together by their property, their symptoms, what they're experiencing and their signs, then maybe we can develop treatments that are better targeted to the individual.
Well, Dr. Sarah McCoy, I hope you can come back and be with us again. It's been a lot of fun. I learned a lot, and I bet our listeners did as well. So you'll have to come back and be with us again. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Sarah McCoy, clinical rheumatologist at UW Health and director of the Sjogren's Syndrome Clinic. It was great to have her with us and great to have you listening in. Tomorrow we'll take a look at the mysterious world of fungi on the program. And boy, there's some diseases relating to fungi you don't want to get. That's for sure. I'm reading the book. Stay with us right here on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.
He said that black smoke was constantly coming out of the burn pits 24/7. And my reaction to it was like, wow, that doesn't sound very safe. Wonder what that's about. And in my mind, I couldn't imagine at the time that type of system operating could potentially harm our service members.
Journalism that seeks and reveals. That's On Point with me, Meghna Chakrabarty.
Today at 1 on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from K&A Greenhouse and Hidden Studios Art Tour. Businesses play an important role in our communities and in funding quality news, talk, and music on WPR. Join at WPR.org/sponsor. Wisconsin Public Radio brings you thoughtful and engaging discussions every day. Authors, artists, politicians, and voices from around the state. You'll hear them all. And you can be a part of the conversation, too, on air or online at WPR.org.